I'd like to call the Fisheries Committee to order on February 12, 2009 at approximately 10:03 according to the clock in the committee. Present for the meeting are Representative Munoz, Representative Book, Vice Chair Keller, Representative Kawasaki, myself, Chair Edgman. We'd like to, of course, remind people to turn their cell phones off. We have a rule here in the Fisheries Committee that we don't charge you cookies, we're going to charge king crab. So we figured that would be an additional incentive. Today's meeting, of course, will feature an overview from the Commissioner of Department of Fish and Game, and also from the Director of the Commercial Fisheries Division of the Department. And I think I mentioned to the committee earlier that, in a normal cycle, we would have started the hearings here from the committee with overviews. But as it turns out, we had conflicting meetings with the Board of Fish, the Pacific Salmon Commission, North Pacific Council, IPHC, I believe, or a number of meetings. I guess not the IPHC, but the Pacific Salmon Commission is what I meant to say. Next week, for your information, we'll be hearing more overviews, and we'll have the Sports Fish Division, the Subsistence Division, and the Division of Habitat, which is now in the Department of Fish and Game, after being gone for a couple of years. We'll have overviews from them, and I'd like to remind everyone that for those online, that the testimony today is invited only, given that we are conducting overviews, and that's the normal practice. One other administrative item is to let everyone know that we are going to move our start time forward 15 minutes to 10:15, as opposed to 10 a.m., and that's in lieu of Representative Munoz and her committee, which has meeting time in this room from 8 to 10, so it gives us a little bit of transition time, about 15 minutes or so. And we worked it out with both Representative Munoz and Representative Heron, the co-chairs of the CNRA committee, and so we think that would work best for everyone. What that means is that we would then conclude our Fisheries Committee meeting at 12:15 as opposed to 12 o'clock, assuming that we go the full distance. So with that, Commissioner, welcome to the table. We appreciate all the work that you and your department are doing and keeping Alaska's legacy as one of the best managers of its fisheries, if not the best in the world. Keep that reputation intact. And with that, if you could please identify yourself and your affiliation for the record, and let's get going.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for the kind introduction. For the record, I'm Denby Lloyd. I'm the commissioner of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. To my left is John Hilsinger, director of our Division of Commercial Fisheries. I'll start off with giving, hopefully, a brief overview of the department structure, very little on the budget, and some indication of the types of fisheries management and research activities that we're involved with, and then ask John to give you a more specific view of the division, if that's what is on your schedule.
And Commissioner, if I could interject, would you prefer to give your testimony and then field questions afterwards, or do you mind questions while you're giving your testimony until they come up?
Mr. Chairman, please ask questions as we go along, if that's your druthers.
Okay, thank you.
Hopefully you have some pieces of material in front of you. I'm going to be referring to a fairly bland black and white set of sheets. It's labeled Overview of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game with today's date. It's three pages. In addition, what we've provided you today is a color brochure that is a facilities map, a statewide facilities map for the department. And it's not so much that I think you might be interested in where all our office buildings are, but rather it's a good graphical description of where we have our area offices and where we conduct our fishery management programs. Also, there are updates on commercial sport fish and wildlife conservation field camps, so that you get a good geographic representation of how we conduct our operations statewide. Back to the black and white overview, Mr. Chairman. Starting with a little bit of background, many of you are aware, but some of you may not be, that Alaska's Constitution is somewhat unique among those of the 50 states, that it expressly describes the responsibility to manage our natural resources on a sustained yield basis. And in fact, there are a number of important phrases in Article 8 of Alaska's Constitution. We are charged with the utilization, development, and conservation of all natural resources belonging to the state for the maximum benefit of our people. And we are to do that on the sustained yield principle, subject to preferential preferences among beneficial uses. That has since been translated down into various statutory and regulatory mandates, and also then to the mission of the department, which is based on statutory language. So specifically, our charge and responsibility to the people of Alaska is to protect, maintain, and improve the fish, game, and aquatic plant resources of the state and manage their use and development in the best interest of the economy and the well-being of the people of the state, consistent, again, with the sustained yield principle. I hope you'll notice here that it's not always maximum sustained yield, but it's certainly sustained yield, and that requires us to always keep in mind the constant protection of a base abundance, as well as a striving to achieve ongoing yields, that is, benefits to humans, largely, in perpetuity. Goals of the department include to optimize the economic benefits from fish and wildlife resources, to optimize public participation in fish and wildlife pursuits, and to increase public knowledge and the public's confidence that wild populations of fish and wildlife are indeed responsibly managed in Alaska. We've taken those mandates to heart and structured ourselves around a number of core services that are common to all the operating divisions of the department. Fundamentally, we need to manage whatever harvest is going on so that we can assure that we're not dipping into the biomass base and thus unduly affecting ongoing productivity. We are also responsible to assess the condition of stocks that are utilized. So again, we have good understanding of their potential productivity. And this becomes particularly important in those instances where we are trying to achieve more than just a fundamental or a small degree of harvest. But in those instances where we want to achieve intensive yield or high levels of yield, we need to have a good solid understanding of the productivity and life history parameters, population dynamics of the populations that we're looking at to harvest in that fashion. Also, a core service for the department is customer service, providing information to fish and wildlife users as well as the legislature and any, in fact, member of the public that has questions about our operations. We also are deeply involved in public involvement, and that's manifest through a number of operations, and many of you are familiar with the Board of Fisheries, the Board of Game. We have very open and public regulatory processes, but also in various manifestations of our research and management planning is conducted with an eye towards engaging the public directly. We're also very concerned about maintaining state sovereignty. States within the United States are charged with the responsibility for managing fish and wildlife, and in Alaska we take that charge and responsibility and authority very, very seriously. Some of you are likely aware of a number of incursions or encroachments to that state sovereignty, manifest through federal legislation like the Marine Mammal Protection Act, sometimes the Endangered Species Act. There are various elements that we need to guard against the potential tension and encroachment of the federal government on what's normally considered to be a state prerogative. One of the most intense arenas that lately we've been dealing with the question of sovereignty is with in front of the Federal Subsistence Board. Given a tension between state law and federal law under the Alaska Native Interest Lands Conservation Act, we are considered to be out of compliance with federal directions on providing subsistence, and thus we are striving to maintain our sovereignty but also work cooperatively with the Federal Subsistence Board in their charge of providing for federal management of subsistence uses on federal public lands within the boundaries of the state of Alaska. In support of these five core services, we've also incorporated into our mindset a responsibility for habitat conservation, and this has become manifest again with the bringing back Habitat Division within the fold of the department, but also in all our base operations within the Fisheries and Wildlife Divisions, we are concerned with maintaining productive and effective habitat for fish and wildlife resources. And finally, Mr. Chairman, although not least of our considerations, is to maintain a well-motivated, challenged, and rewarded workforce. This has become increasingly challenging over the last few years as there's a growing pay differential between state employment and our federal brethren, sister agencies on the federal side, as well as the public or the private workforce. And so we have dedicated ourselves to a substantial effort internally to various workforce development issues.
While we have a pause here, Commissioner, let me just let the record reflect that both Representative Johnson and Millett have joined us and have been here for some time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page two, there's some more detailed description of various ambitions that we've set ourselves within those core services. I won't go through all those, but there's some level of detail here if any of you wish to either peruse that and ask questions or question us later during the session. We'd be more than happy to address your inquiries. On page three, there's a section labeled Structure and Budget. Basically, the department comprises six divisions, Commercial Fisheries Division and the Sport Fish Division, the Wildlife Conservation Division, Subsistence, Habitat, and also a Division of Administrative Services. In addition, we administer the activities of the Alaska Boards of Fisheries and Game, the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, and the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council. In the Commissioner's office, in addition to my position, we have two deputies, we have an assistant commissioner, and a number of special assistants that help us address legislative issues, federal issues, public communication issues, and other aspects that need to be coordinated on a department-wide basis. Our FY09 operating budget was right at $180 million from 16 funding sources, about $58 million of that in state general funds. So obviously there's a large difference there, much of it made up by license fees as well as federal budget contributions. Our FY10 operating budget request is also right at $180 million. Level funding, there's a bit of shifting between various sources, but we're still relying on 16 funding sources and just over $58 million in state general funds in that request. Finally, Mr. Chairman, as I know you're aware and some other committee members may be, we deal with a lot of other agencies when we're involved with the management and research of fish and wildlife in Alaska and offshore Alaska. Central to some of those considerations are interactions with the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, which is the federal equivalent, I suppose, of our own Alaska State Board of Fisheries, but they deal with management of federal fisheries in waters from 3 to 200 miles off of Alaska's coastline. I have a seat on that council, so in somewhat at odds with our role with the Board of Fisheries, where we take a very neutral stance on allocation issues. In the federal arena, the state of Alaska is well represented in a number of those allocation issues so that we can look out for the benefits of the state in federal decisions that are made for those fisheries between 3 and 200 miles. We're also represented in a non-voting fashion in the Pacific Fishery Management Council. Those are waters off of Washington, Oregon, California. We deal internationally with the North Pacific Anadromous Fish Commission. We deal domestically with the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission, which is largely a fishery information and data processing organization. The department deals directly with our University of Alaska fisheries programs, our Alaska Sea Grant program. The commissioner is an ex officio secretary, but not a voting member of the State Board of Fisheries and Board of Game. We deal with the Bering Sea Fishery Advisory Board. And as I mentioned earlier, the Federal Subsistence Board, we have a non-voting seat, and that's an interesting arena for us to deal in. But we provide quite a bit of the factual information that the Federal Subsistence Board relies upon to perform their duties of dealing with management of subsistence opportunity on federal public lands. There are a number of other organizations, Mr. Chairman, that we deal with, so our lives are busy coordinating both publicly and internally on scientific, technical, and management issues. That's my overview, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Questions, committee members? Representative Keller?
Yeah, thank you, Chair, and thank you for your presentation, Denby. Would you go over again what you said about the fact that the Constitution doesn't use the word maximum? And the real question is, when would you not manage for maximum yield, maximum sustained yield? As I read that phrase, it's in the best interest of the people, economy, and well-being. It seems like the word maximum isn't there, but it seems like it's implied. And I think I missed when. So the question is, when would you not manage fish and game for maximum yield?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Keller, that is an interesting line of argument. The Constitution does refer to maximum benefit to the people, so the word maximum is there. It's not in the phrase maximum sustained yield. Very specifically, the Constitution refers to the sustained yield principle. Arguably, in many instances, that would translate into an attempt to try to achieve maximum sustained yield, but not necessarily in all cases. And I guess I'll give one conceptual likelihood where maximum benefit may not be maximum yield, and that's in the case of a sport fishery, where you're not necessarily interested in the most pounds necessarily, but you might be interested in the best beneficial use, whether that's expenditures in lodges and in businesses, or if it's a wilderness experience or things like that. You don't necessarily achieve that through the most pounded fish harvested. Sometimes you do, but oftentimes you wouldn't.
That, you know, could follow up. It just, that seems to me like managing for maximum yield. You know, that's the way I would interpret that, is taking all those things into account. So I guess it's probably just semantics and my lack of understanding of constitutional language.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's not an immaterial concern, but maximum benefit, dealing with perhaps economic or social benefits, doesn't necessarily align itself with maximum poundage or actual yield of fish flesh in all cases.
Thank you.
Other questions, committee members? Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, see you.
See you too, sir.
Happy Thursday. In your presentation, you talked about North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, and your statement was that we're well represented. Could you explain in a little bit more detail what you meant by that?
Mr. Chairman, the chief, in this case the commissioner of the State Department of Fish and Game, has a seat in all the relevant federal regional councils. So for the Alaska Council, I have a seat on it. Also, the voting composition of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, there are 11 voting members. 6 of those, including my seat, are from the state of Alaska. So we have, by virtue of the construction of the voting membership, a majority number of votes. Now, that doesn't mean that always all Alaskans are voting as a block or in line, but by virtue of the Magnuson-Stevens Act that set up these regional management councils, it was an explicit decision to give Alaska 6 voting seats on that council.
Follow-up, Ms. Representative Book?
I was wondering if you could give members of the committee actually a breakdown of the various opportunities that are represented by this, as a matter of how we're represented on these councils, what that means. Do you have a flow chart to that extent that actually gives us a breakdown so that we know what it is that we're involved in the state?
Representative Book, I might intervene here and suggest that if you get an opportunity to go to the North Pacific Fishery Management Council website, and there's a really good breakout there that might be your first avenue to get a better glimpse at what the council is all about. Was that your question?
No, I'm talking about the whole list. We have a whole litany here of prescribed involvements, and just as somebody, as a new person to this, it would help me immensely if I knew what that involvement really was and what that undertaking meant.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Book, we don't have flow charts for all of these, but I'd be happy to have a conversation with you if that would be helpful. and line out, to the best of my ability, what the structure of each of these are and what our representation on all of them are.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Thank you. At the last meeting, we had a lot of testimony on the southeast herring issue and the state of the herring, particularly concern over the sacro fishery and the herring fisheries. And one of the people that testified, a scientist, stated that she thought that ADF&G did not have a complete model, an accurate stock model for herring, and perhaps it's because of underfunding or maybe other factors. But could you comment on that, please?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Munoz, I didn't hear that testimony, so I'm not sure exactly what the implication was. But yes, we have a fairly fundamental herring program statewide. It's probably better in southeast Alaska than it is in most other places, and perhaps Director Hilsinger can address it in more detail during his presentation. But there's probably always room for improvement. It's not a species or a set of fisheries that we've been focused on in the last few years. But the exception to that is, or one exception to that, is the Sitka sacro fishery, where we have maintained a good research presence and a good management presence there continuously for, I don't know, the last 15, 20 years.
Follow up? And a lot of testimony, too, provided anecdotal information of observation that suggested that the herring stocks were disappearing from many areas. And I know that the biomass is, that the populations move, and I understand that, but that there is real concern that herring may be depleted, and that I think we need to take an active look at herring, since it is the base of the food chain, so to speak.
Was there a question there? I'm sorry.
Just that I would hope that the department would find that the health of the herring stock region-wide is of utmost importance, because it is the base of our salmon and the health of our salmon species, and much of many of our species depend on a healthy herring stock.
Yes, ma'am. And we certainly do recognize that, and we're engaged right now in a review by the National Marine Fisheries Service of all of southeast herring stocks based on a concern about this low level of abundance. But even ongoing in our southeast regional office, we're not just looking at the Sitka herring stock, but stocks around southeast. I think they recognize that there are some stocks that aren't as productive or aren't even as abundant as they used to be. We're concerned about that, but we believe also that southeast herring as a whole is in healthy shape. We register your concern, and we've certainly registered concerns from a number of users throughout southeast.
Thank you.
Additional questions from committee members for the commissioner? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I don't want to blindside you on this, but I don't think I will. Commissioner, and I've had several people, this is revolving around the Cook Inlet Salmon Task Force. I've had several people in my office who indicated to me that the DNA sampling that has come out of the Department of Fish and Game over the last few years is flawed, and it cannot be trusted to, it's not an accurate measure of where the fish are living, and I want to put on the record either affirmative that is true, it didn't come from your department, by the way, or that it is. I just want on the record the assessment of the DNA testing in the Upper Cook Inlet. Is it accurate? Can we depend on it? We wasted our money. Would you just put on the record your feelings about that testing program?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I think actually the program's pretty good, and it's been proven over time to give us increasing discernment, ability to discern stocks at an ever finer level over the last 10, 15 years. We started with a process in the mid-90s of dealing with what's called electrophoresis, and that's the separation of proteins as an indication of genetic stock structure, and that gave us some basic level of information. The newer information based on SNPs, which are single nucleotide polymorphisms, gives us a much finer look at stock structure in the mixed stock fisheries in the inlet. I'm not sure the basis of the criticism that they're inaccurate, but perhaps that's a reflection of some people finding that even with increased discernment, we can't answer each and every question. But I believe that the department's program has developed a very strong ability to determine what, in general, are stock movements through the inlet, and we're referring specifically to sockeye sand.
Right.
And then our ability to characterize in real time, I think, is still in question. Real time meaning on a daily or a weekly basis on a very fine spatial scale. We haven't achieved that yet, but we haven't suggested that we have achieved that. So again, we may not be able to answer everybody's questions, but I still think that we've developed a very strong program that has answered a whole lot more questions than we were able to in the mid-90s.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just
please
a specific. Is it possible through DNA testing to tell what stream a fish comes from within a 90% accuracy rate?
Mr. Chairman, I
or
believe
an area stream.
Yeah, I believe
there's
that
several.
That,
there's some. I understand the genetic similarities, genetically similar streams. I guess.
As I understand it, Mr. Chairman, it is possible in some cases, and that the classification tests that are used often use a 90%. Verification as a threshold against which the information is either considered reliable or not. But I don't know enough about the details of the studies to say that in all cases each baseline spawning stock that we have is discernible at the 90% level.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It was important for me to get that on the record as I'm getting mixed signals from different groups. And in a budget subcommittee, it's not on the record, so I wanted to make sure that in this committee that at least we did have a record of the department's position on their DNA testing. And I appreciate it, Mr. Kirsch. I happen to think you're doing a very good job with it. So
thank you.
Other questions for the commissioner while he's at the table? I'll ask my one question then. Commissioner, back to North Pacific Fishery Management Council, in the fact that if I recall correctly, its meeting schedule is laid out 3 years in advance, and the council meets in Portland, Seattle, Sitka, sometimes Girdwood, mostly Anchorage, Kodiak, on Alaska on occasion when they can get out there. And these meetings are set in advance and budgeted for, I presume, and basically, you know, established in stone. The Board of Fisheries, however, and I've got a bill that addresses this issue, is required in statute. I think the wording is somewhat ambiguous about meeting in particular areas of the state, but they're not necessarily required, or there's not that type of a same type of meeting schedule as the North Pacific Council has. And back to Vice Chairman Keller's comments about you know, the maximum benefit and how looking at the constitutional language here in Article 8, how the resources belong to the state of Alaska and so on and so forth. But your comment, Commissioner, on the Board of Fish making its utmost effort to go out and meet in the areas where the fisheries occur and hear from local people and you know, be present to allow not just the advisory committee folks who might be able to travel to an anchorage or some other urban setting, but to have the fishermen themselves be able to come before the Board of Fish, but your comments on that observation.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you're aware that the Board of Fish in particular meets on a three-year rotation. So any particular area of the state is scheduled for a meeting every 3 years. It's a little bit different than the North Pacific Fishery Management process for scheduling. But the geographic location of the Board of Fisheries meetings are determined by the board by vote. Usually laid out a year and a half in advance, and their considerations are based around a desire to have meetings in the areas that the fisheries are conducted, but also tempered somewhat with travel and other meeting logistics, as well as composition of the fleets that actually participate in those fisheries. So I'm aware of strong concern by local residents in Bristol Bay region, for example, to have the next Bristol Bay meeting in the region, Dillingham or King Salmon Naknek, something like that. I know the Board of Fisheries has considered that issue a number of times, and if I can somewhat characterize their discussion, up to this point, they've realized that the previous meeting had been conducted in Dillingham. It was a great location. It was a very good meeting. The board was well received by the public and locals in Dillingham. But so then for this session, they had concluded that because of some logistical constraints, but also a desire to make the board meeting more immediately accessible to fishermen that fish Bristol Bay but live in other regions of the state, which there are a high percentage, that they felt that a meeting in a central location like Anchorage would help them reach those other users that aren't reached directly through Dillingham. My sense, Mr. Chairman, is that we ought to take every effort to meet in the region of the fisheries, but I guess I haven't come to a point of being absolute about that in my recommendations, because we do have a broad suite of interested fishermen. So, for example, there are a lot of fishermen that fish Bristol Bay that live in other areas of Alaska that have to go through Anchorage if they were to go to Dillingham. There's certainly a lot of non-residents that participate in the fisheries, and while our state constitution itself doesn't necessarily look after non-residents, the federal constitution does, and there are a number of things that we can or can't do to discriminate between residents and non-residents. But anyway, those are the types of considerations that go on and that the board discusses in determining where their meeting locations are. As I understand it, they're considering requests now, again, to even again reconsider whether or not that Bristol Bay meeting will be held in that location or not. Maybe a long-winded answer to your question, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you for that response. Just to provide a quick comment back, if there's sort of one maybe useful byproduct of the 90-day session, which the legislature has been engaged in these last 2 years, maybe this is more my opinion, but there appears to be more sort of committee outreach, more traveling out to some of the far reaches of Alaska. We held meetings in Barrow and Nome and Kotzebue, and we're going to Bethel and Dillingham and other areas around the state, and the benefits of doing that are immeasurable. And in terms of engaging remote areas in the political process, and I'm not sitting here weighing in on the 90-day versus 120-day session, but using that as a measure of the benefits of the Board of Fisheries, which it's the Alaska Board of Fisheries, and it's charge to involve local voices as much as possible. And in the instance of the Bristol Bay fishery, certainly local means a lot of other areas outside of the region by itself. But as you and I have discussed privately, I'm going to do everything I possibly can to encourage the board to meet in outlying areas, and certainly in the upcoming Bristol Bay meeting in December. That's important to the region, it's important to me, and I think it should be important to the Board of Fish. And so I'll conclude that line of questioning, Commissioner, and I don't see any other hands raised or heads nodding, and we'd certainly appreciate further dialogue with you as the session proceeds, and appreciate your time this morning. So
all right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
With that, let's turn to Director Hilsinger, and as we ask you always, to identify yourself and your affiliation, and we'll go forward from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Hilsinger. I'm the Director of the Division of Commercial Fisheries. It's a pleasure to be here again. The similar to the department as a whole, the mission of the Division of Commercial Fisheries is to manage, protect, rehabilitate, enhance, and develop the fisheries and aquatic plant resources in the interest of the economy and general well-being of the state, consistent with the sustained yield principle, and subject to allocations between user groups that are established through the public regulatory processes, such as the Alaska Board of Fisheries. We have a number of responsibilities. Probably first and foremost is to manage the commercial, personal use, and subsistence fisheries within state waters. This represents a wide variety of salmon, herring, shellfish, and groundfish fisheries that occur within state waters. We also manage the many of the shellfish species and some groundfish species, even in federal waters. The Bering Sea, King, and Tanner crab, snow crab fisheries we manage in federal waters, scallops, and some of the rockfish species we manage out to 200 miles. And that's because the federal government recognized that the state had a far better developed program and better capabilities to manage those species, even in federal waters. We also conduct a lot of applied research. We plan and permit the fish hatcheries, the shellfish hatchery, and aquatic farms. We deal in the negotiation of fishing agreements with primarily with Canada through the Pacific Salmon Treaty and the Yukon River Agreement. That's a portion of the Pacific Salmon Treaty. And we coordinate extensively with the federal agencies, National Marine Fisheries Service, the Federal Subsistence Board, the International Pacific Halibut Commission, and in their management. The division manages a wide variety of fisheries, and from, for example, the salmon fisheries in Kuskokwim Bay, which are characterized by small open skiffs, all the way to the crab fisheries in the Bering Sea that are characterized by large modern vessels fishing far offshore. Ex-vessel value of Alaska's commercial fisheries stands currently at about 1.6 billion, no, billion, sorry, $1.6 billion. That's the amount of money paid directly to the fishermen. About 50% of that is from groundfish. Salmon represents about 25% of that ex-vessel value, or about $409 million. Shellfish and halibut are each at about 14% of that value, around $225 million. And herring at about 15 to $18 million is about 1% of that total ex-vessel value statewide. And you can see that that value has been growing for about the last 6 or 7 years. We're seeing increased value in salmon, and prices of salmon are coming up, and so we have seen growing value in those fisheries. The recent economic study of the commercial fishery indicated that the commercial fishery generates about 78,000 jobs in the seafood harvesting, processing, and support industries, and that Alaskans hold about almost 49,000 of these jobs. And there's $774 million in direct payments to labor, with about $237 million of that going to Alaska residents.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On your, I asked this in a overview of Department of Transportation, and I want to ask you the same question. The 78,519 jobs, there was a huge number of jobs that the airport said they had. And I ask, if someone flying a fish is counted as an airport job or a fisheries job? And they said probably both. So what's the real number? And can we trust those numbers? Or, I mean, where are we? Where can we get a copy of the survey to look at the the methodology? I mean, do you know the answer to that question? Because they certainly assume that it would probably be counted as a job in both areas.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I don't know the direct answer to that question. We do have a copy of the study that Northern Economics did and just published, which we could make available. And I think my purpose here, more than trying to detail these things, is to indicate in general the importance of the commercial fishery, and because that's an indication of how seriously we take our responsibility to manage it.
And I certainly, but I think when you said you wanted to detail, I would hope the details would be accurate. And for you to put a number up there of 78,519 jobs, I hope it's more. I mean, I hope that's the number. I mean, I know there's a lot, but when you say detail, to me that's accurate. And is it accurate, and is it a misrepresentation, intentional or not, to count a job as a, and you could just go down the list, is it a trucker, so there's truckers have 15,000, so is that person trucking the fish to the airport to fly away three jobs or one job? So those are the kind of questions that I would like to know. If we're going to make assessments on values and number, if we're going to be touting the numbers, let's make sure they're accurate. If we don't need to tout the numbers, that's fine. But I would like to, and I'll go through the report, and I've asked for one for the transportation as well. And I certainly would at some point like to talk to the Northern Economics Group to find out how their methodology is, because I don't think I can see that in that book that you have. So, Mr. Chairman, I just would like to be accurate with the numbers that we get. And the same translates all the way down through the jobs, the money. If it's a dollar spent transporting a fish to an airplane, is it a dollar to the truck, a dollar to the airport, and a dollar to the fishery, which it really looks like $3 when it's really only $1. So those are questions that, and it's odd that the same company is doing all of the research. So that's kind of the red flag to me to see where we're going. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Director, response?
Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to make the report available, and I'm not an economist, and so unfortunately I can't give you a detailed answer on how their methodology worked. Gunnar Knapp recently provided a pretty thorough analysis of both the sport fishing study and the commercial fishing value study to the Cook Inlet Task Force, and which I found very helpful myself in trying to understand the comparisons between the two industries.
Can I follow up?
No, it's not. I would like to go back. Is it easily accessible to you, like the graph that you were looking at there in back one slide, where it shows the excess ex-vessel value, the actual poundage? I mean, would that be easy information to come, just to kind of compare the market with the actual production in the different categories? Or, I mean, where would I look for that if you don't have it easily available?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Keller, we could certainly provide that. That would not be difficult to put together. But I don't have it with me.
I find it really interesting. I just thought.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Any additional questions? Not seeing any yet. We'll continue.
Mr. Chairman, again, based on the Northern Economic Study, there is a very large economic impact from commercial fishing. And again, that's an indication of the importance that we place on trying to provide the best management program that we can. The commercial fishery also is one of the largest contributors of tax revenue to the state after the oil and gas industry. The division's core services include stock assessment and applied research, harvest management, laboratory services, aquaculture permitting, data processing, and information services and public participation. In the stock assessment and applied research arena, we do a large number of projects, many of which are related to salmon escapement enumeration. We run fish counting weirs, towers, sonar projects, do foot and aerial surveys, all over the state of Alaska. We also, in many cases, do estimates of juvenile salmon production. We conduct shellfish and groundfish surveys in almost all of the coastal areas of the state, herring spawn deposition surveys and hydroacoustic surveys, also aerial surveys for herring and dive surveys for a variety of species, herring, gooey ducks, red sea cucumbers. And we also do a large amount of biological sampling for the biological characteristics, age, sex, and length of the catch, genetic sampling. We have a tremendous genetics program. In fact, we probably have the largest fisheries genetics lab in the world. And we have a large coated wire tag sampling program and otolith sampling program. These are methods whereby oftentimes hatchery fish are marked and we can determine hatchery fish in the catch. Our salmon enumeration program, as I noted, is quite large and varied.
Can I jump in here? We've got a question from Representative Book.
Okay. And if Representative you could Kalsaki. Back up a couple statements. You mentioned that you have one of the largest available studies available, and where does that take place at, where you're doing some of these samplings and some of these you said you have a facility here in the state of Alaska, one of the largest in the world. Where is that located?
Representative Edgman, Representative Book, we have our what we call our gene conservation laboratory. It's located in Anchorage at the Raspberry Road office, and they have the capability to process probably between 50 and 70,000 genetic samples a year, actually maybe even more than that. We were involved in a very large project in Western Alaska sampling chum and sockeye salmon from all the commercial and subsistence fisheries, starting at Chignik and going all the way around the Alaska Peninsula and all the way up to Norton Sound, where we've collected 220,000 genetic samples, and we collect about 70,000 a year. A normal genetics lab probably processes 5,000 to 10,000 samples a year, and we can do about 15 to 30 times that number. So it really is a world-class facility.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that.
Any other questions while we're here? Representative Kawasaki, I'm sorry, and then Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Hilsinger. I appreciate the previous slide talking about the research and the stock assessments and applied science put into the programs. I just have an observation that, for instance, the Yukon King returns this year are anticipated to be lowest in decades, or maybe the lowest ever. And with all this science and information that's provided nowadays that we didn't have before, we had a lot of anecdotal information that Representative Munoz brought up yesterday on the herring fishery. I guess I just find it sort of odd that we don't have conclusive evidence one way or another, and I just wanted to hear maybe your opinion of it, again, whether you believe that there's enough money put into the science and research aspect of your job.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kawasaki, the Yukon King is a pretty significant issue for us. We recognize that that's an area that has probably arguably the greatest economic need of any area of the state. We have improved that program dramatically. I was the regional supervisor for the AYK region in the early 1990s, and that program was, I think I would describe it then as rudimentary, and it's improved by light years since that time. We now have a sonar at Pilot Station that gives us a good indication of what's coming into the river. We have a very advanced program up at Eagle where we can get a very accurate indication of the number of fish going across the border into Canada. We actually learned through this work that there were approximately twice as many king salmon crossing the border into Canada as we previously thought. And this has given us the ability to rethink the escapement goals in Canada. It's been quite a major improvement in the program, and it's also allowed us to get a much better understanding of the production of those Canadian king salmon. And what we see right now is that the Canadian origin king salmon are producing at very low levels, about one return per spawner, whereas normally they would be producing at 3 to 4 returns per spawner. Now, we don't have the ability to know precisely why that production is so poor right now, but we do have the ability to forecast it, which we didn't before. You remember probably the Western Alaska fishery disaster in 1998, 99, and 2000, when we really didn't at that time have near the ability to predict these things. And now we do, so even though we can't necessarily explain them, we can make management plans ahead of time. We can alert people to the potential problems so they can make other plans in their life, and so I think we are making progress. Are there more things that we could use in those fisheries? Yes, and later I'll talk about one increment that we'll have that will provide some additional money to replace projects that used to be funded by the federal government and have been cut, and that's one of the problems that we face there. And last year the legislature funded Yukon at almost $1 million in an increment to replace federal funds that were cut. And so there are programs that we would like to have on the Yukon, and we're taking steps to try to see that they get funded.
Follow-up, Professor Kawasaki?
No, I appreciate that answer, and I will definitely keep an eye on the increment that's in there for the Yukon area. And just to point out another thing, earlier when you said that it's an economic issue, it's not only an economic issue for a lot of those interior villages that rely on that food year-round for sustenance. So I just wanted to point that out to you. Thank you.
I do have a follow-up before we go to Representative Munoz and Representative Book. I didn't get to see the governor's press conference yesterday or even get to really read about it, but obviously we have the situations in Amonok and Kotlik, and if you talk to some of the local folks, they think that the fisheries there, you know, could be managed in a way that would allow for more harvest, or I think as one person told me, maybe to take the test boat and move it over to the side of the channel so you can, you know, have a better gauge of the fish are actually going up the river, and maybe that allows for an increased harvest down the road. But your comment on any efforts to for the department to approach managing the fishery any different in light of the governor's interest in providing more or getting some relief out to the lower Yukon?
Mr. Chairman, the staff and department have been involved in a number of efforts to improve that. One, they've been meeting in the communities along the river with people to discuss better ways to manage the subsistence fishery. It's a very difficult fishery to manage. The Yukon River from the mouth to the headwaters is about 2,000 miles, and it takes a fish probably 8 weeks or more to swim that distance, and so it's crucial to the people along the river if we do have fishery restrictions in order to meet spawning escapement goals, it can have very different impacts on different communities based on where those fish are, because they travel up the river in pulses. And so if a pulse is at your village when the fishery's open, you may get all the fish you you need if the pulse happens to be at your village when the fish is closed, when the fishery is closed, then you may not. And later pulses may not have as many fish. So there's a lot of issues like that about the actual operations of the fishery. And so the staff are meeting with in communities along the river to get input from the users about how it would work the best for them to try to implement any restrictions that are necessary. We've also been meeting with, in Lower River, with some of the people involved in the commercial fisheries. And the issue there is people recognize that the Chinook run is poor, but there is a large summer chum run. And those two runs overlap to a large extent. And so the question is, how do you protect the Chinook but allow harvest of the summer chums? And so we've been talking to some of the people there about the potential for additional test fisheries, some test fisheries in a new location outside the mouth of the river that may give us more advanced warning of when these fish are coming in. They come in these pulses, and so it's would be really valuable to know ahead of time when a pulse is coming. And so we're trying to do as much as we can to try to make those summer chum available to the commercial fishery, and but still protect the Chinook salmon, and then make the amount of Chinook salmon that the subsistence use is, make them available to the subsistence fishermen. And so that's a difficult task. And the last 2 years, when we've had very poor Chinook runs, we have allowed some summer chum fishing, and that's been very controversial, extremely controversial. And there's many people who think we shouldn't allow any commercial fishing whatsoever, even if there's just a few Chinook salmon caught incidentally. So we're trying to work with the people all along the river to come up with a management plan that allows everybody to make the most of the resource that we can.
Representative Munoz.
Oh, thank you. I'd like to get back to the herring issue again, and just really very concerned about the state of the herring stocks in Southeast, and wondering if the department, I remember that the comment that was made by the commissioner, but if you can comment on the department's role in restoring herring stocks, and if we're doing enough at this point.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Munoz, as Commissioner Lloyd said, we have a pretty advanced herring program in Southeast Alaska, probably the best one in the state. And we do, not only do we fly aerial surveys, which is typically would be the only stock assessment tool. If you go out to a place like Togiak in Bristol Bay, that's really about the only stock assessment tool there is. So we fly aerial surveys in Southeast Alaska. We have test fisheries. We do the spawn deposition dive surveys. We actually have divers who go down and sample along transects and pick up the spawn on kelp and get an idea of the density of that. And last year, actually at Sitka, we found some of the greatest spawn density that we've ever seen in any area ever. And then we also do extensive catch sampling, so we know the size, the age, the sex ratio. We have that information. And those things all go into two different models that indicate what the abundance of herring is. And those predictions of those models are ground truth through the aerial surveys, because what people do is train their eye to the size of a school. We actually, at different times, will go out and actually catch a school of herring with the biologist in the air, and the biologist thinks it's 50 tons, and then when we wrap up the school and weigh all the herring in it, we can get a calibration of how good their aerial survey abilities are. And we have excellent aerial surveyors in Southeast Alaska. So we have a number of different means that we use to determine the abundance of herring and see that it it makes sense in terms of all the other indicators we have. Is it enough? You know, that's a good question. I think there's some things that we'd like to have in our herring program that we don't have. We've seen erosion in the herring budget over the years, and we used to have a statewide herring biometrician who worked with all the areas of the state and did a lot of the analysis, and that position's has gone now because of erosion of the budget. But in general, particularly in Sitka, you know, we see that population growing each year, and it's as large as we've ever seen it. It's grown from year to year, and so we don't see a major cause for concern as the population is growing. Now, we can't really assess right now what the future effects of things like climate change may be, increases in humpback whales. We think that in some of our herring stocks, like in Prince William Sound, it may actually be humpback whales may be one of the reasons that that stock is not rebounding. There's more humpback whales, and they spend a good part of the summer feeding right in the area where a lot of those herring are. I'm not sure what our ability to limit the humpback whale population is, but it's probably pretty limited. And so, you know, we may see things with climate change that are challenges for management, but we're certainly aware that there's that potential, and we'll try to deal with it the best we can.
Okay, thank you. Do you think there could be a correlation between less salmon and less herring? Do you think that they're related, or do you not find a relation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Munoz, it's difficult. Some salmon species feed on herring as well as other things, and other salmon species probably don't. And so you see areas where you do have very healthy salmon runs, but the herring are at low numbers, and you see other areas where the herring appear to be very healthy, but the salmon are at low numbers in some years. So there doesn't seem to be a real direct correlation with that, and that may be because of the variety of foods they eat and their ability to shift over and eat other things.
Before we go to Representative Book, I have a follow-up as well. We heard some on the subject. We heard some fairly passionate testimony on Tuesday, and the crux of it all seemed to be that the Pacific herring is sort of a bellwether species that really measures the health of the overall ecosystem in the Southeast fisheries, and that the stocks as a whole are declining, and it's a downward trend, and that the department has not been responsive in terms of maybe looking at the fishery in a more holistic manner, standing back maybe in a different way as opposed to using the traditional management tools that you described, but standing back a little bit and factoring in these larger external events, global warming, climate change, whatever it is, as well as increased predator presence with the warming of the water, and that maybe it was time for the department to have update their models or modify them to some degree. But what would your comment be to those concerns?
Mr. Chairman, we're very open to working with other scientists. To date, we haven't really had that opportunity. There was some work presented here the other day, and we really have not had the opportunity to review that work. We've seen one public presentation of kind of summarized data, but we haven't really had the opportunity to look at those models and see what the inputs are and what the predictions are and how they relate to, you know, the other estimates of abundance. But we would be happy to work with those scientists and see if there isn't a better way to interpret the data. We've enlisted the assistance of one of the professors at the University of Alaska who's working with our biometrician to help improve that model, and it's my understanding they've made some improvements. So I think we're very open to that, and we would be happy to see the results of any other work and discuss how those things might improve our work.
Thank you. President Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to bounce back just for a second to your thoughts on the Yukon River, if I might, through the chair. You mentioned that there's 2,000 miles of river to the headwaters. How much of that is under your guys actually in Alaskan territory?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Book, it's about 1,200 miles to the border. And then there's another, you know, 800 miles or so in Canada that's managed by the Department of Fisheries and Oceans in Canada. And we have an agreement with the Canadians as part of the Pacific Salmon Treaty. There's a Yukon agreement. And so there's a Yukon River panel and a Yukon River Joint Technical Committee. And both those bodies are made up of U.S. and Canadian people, and they meet twice annually. And actually, the panel makes a lot of the decisions about how the fishery will be managed in terms of the number of fish that we put across the border into Canada. And so a lot of that's worked out in that international arena.
Thank you. Must be mind reading now. Matt. Thanks.
We've got approximately 50 minutes left in the two-hour time slot for the committee, and we've got several slides to go, so it would be the chair's intent to try to get through the full presentation and certainly to accommodate questions, but being mindful that we have a limited amount of time.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. We do, as I mentioned, have a number of other types of stock assessment surveys. We do the extensive dive surveys. We have a highly developed dive program. We also do shellfish and groundfish surveys, and occasionally do surveys for things like clams. In terms of harvest management, we spend a great deal of our resources assisting the Board of Fisheries in establishing regulations and management plans. We have an area staff spread across the state that opens and closes fisheries and monitors stocks and collects biological data and reports on all that information. In the laboratory services, we have a pathology laboratory that is responsible for reviewing and approving transfers of fish and shellfish. They actually have disease samples from a great array of areas around the state, and if a person wants to transport fish or shellfish, say a hatchery wants to start a new stocking program and they want to get their brood stock from a particular location and then stock them into another location, that all has to be permitted, and it's all reviewed by our pathologist to ensure that there's no disease concerns. The coated wire tag and otolith aging laboratory is an extremely important part of our management of hatchery stocks. The hatcheries mark their fish, and then we can actually identify those fish in commercial fisheries, so we know what proportion of the commercial catch is bound for which hatchery. And then, as I mentioned before, the genetic stock identification laboratory is one of the largest. And an interesting thing about that, it's such a valuable tool that virtually every fishery in the state is clamoring for more genetic stock identification information and this particularly in-season information that can give the manager more timely information about how the stocks move through. And as large a lab as it is, we still are limited in our capacity to do work in season. So we have to be fairly careful about what we agree to do in season. But again, back to the Yukon River, we actually do in season genetics on the Yukon Chinook run, the samples taken at pilot station, so that we can identify the proportion of Canadian fish as the run goes through and try to manage the fishery to reduce the harvest rate on those Canadian fish so we can get enough fish into Canada to meet the escapement and their harvest needs. And so it is a really valuable tool, and we're using it as much as we can. Aquaculture permitting, we permit the private nonprofit salmon hatcheries, also the aquatic shellfish hatchery in Seward, and all of the aquatic shellfish farms. In data processing, each commercial landing is required to provide a harvest report. One of the really big advancements in this arena is our e-landing electronic catch reporting system. For 50 years since statehood, people have made out a paper multi-carbon fish ticket, and now we've got the e-landing systems where the processors can actually enter that data electronically. It's being used right now for groundfish and crab. We're expanding now into salmon, and we've been doing our first tests. Salmon is a real challenge because the fish are delivered to relatively small tenders, and so we've actually been out on tenders doing tests with them entering the data into e-landings. The overwhelming response, I think, has been positive from the processors. In general, they love this system, and the salmon tender operators we worked with last year were very positive about it. So this allows the companies to not only report to us on a almost instantaneous basis, but it also allows them to download that information right into their own accounting system. So it eliminates a lot of the double entry of data, and it's been a really big advancement. We've worked a lot to try to get internet accessible catch and catch reporting, and also develop databases. And a good example of this is the Mariner database in Bristol Bay, where people can get online. They can get the daily run updates as the fish come in, and that's proven to be quite valuable. Information services and public information. We maintain the division's website, publish a large number of reports and brochures. We actually now on our website and in our report database, I think we have over 3,000 scientific reports that are accessible through that system, and so that's been a big advantage to people to be able to access some of the data. A lot of it is in the various report series that before were archived in area and regional offices, and if somebody wanted a copy of one, they had to call up and get someone to Xerox it and mail it to them, and so now these are much more available. The division is divided into four regions plus headquarters. We have, of course, the Southeast region. South Central region includes Prince William Sound, Cook Inlet, and Bristol Bay. The Westward region, Kodiak, Chignik, the Alaska Peninsula, and the Bering Sea. And then the AYK region, Arctic Yukon, Kuskokwim, takes up about the northern two-thirds of the state. We've got 310 permanent full-time staff, 472 seasonals. The seasonal staff primarily engaged in biological sampling and fish counting and surveys. We've got 20 permanent offices and 84 seasonal offices and field camps. We probably have one of the broadest presences around the state of any state agency. We also operate 6 large research vessels, 2 in southeast, 2 in central region in Cordova and Homer, and then we have 2 in Kodiak that work in the westward region. Our missions and measures, we have 4 targets that are set out to meet. One is to try to maintain an ex-vessel value in the commercial harvest and mariculture production above $1 billion. And you can see that in recent years, that ex-vessel value has been well above $1 billion and has been increasing. The second one is to meet our reproductive goals. That would be things like salmon spawning escapement goals. And we try to achieve those in at least 80% of our monitored stocks. And currently we do that at about 90% of our stocks. And so we're well above our goal in that target. The third one is to develop genetic baselines for Chinook, Chum, and Sockeye stocks and try to get at least 100 stocks in each of those baselines. And we've met that goal for Chinook with about 110 stocks, and we're well over 80 stocks for chum salmon and about 90 for sockeye. So we're closing in on that goal of 100 stocks. And that's an area that we try to put some energy every year. We send crews out to try to expand that baseline because the quality of your genetic analysis is related very directly to the quality of your baseline. And finally, the goal of having all the aquatic farms operating with current permits. and we're now at 100% of those farms. In the 2003-2004, it turned out that a number of the farms, their permits had expired. And so we set a goal of trying to get all those re-permitted so they were current, and we've met that goal. Our FY 2010 budget request is for a total of $60,488,000, very similar to our FY 2009 request of just over $60 million. And that $60 million is broken down about $36 million general fund, which is about 59% of the total budget. About 15% or $8.7 million is federal money. And the remaining 26% comes from a variety of sources. That would be things like test fish funds, the fish and game funds, CFEC receipts, statutorily designated receipts, a variety of other funding sources. The two increments I mentioned earlier, the Yukon River subsistence projects, these are two projects that the Office of Subsistence Management, Federal Office of Subsistence Management, funded and cut those funds, and we'd like to try to continue those projects. One is a Nenana test wheel video monitoring system where we actually monitor the run. We hire a local person with their fish wheel, and by using a video camera, we don't have to monitor the wheel 24 hours a day to actually count how many fish it's catching. This is a pretty effective means of getting the counts without spending a lot of money. And then the second one is the fall chum salmon drift test fishery. That's also, or at the mouth of the river. That's a project that had been ongoing for many years and was cut by Office of Subsistence Management. And the fall chum fishery is a very difficult one to manage because the fish come in short pulses. And between those pulses, there's very little entry. And so dependent on the weather, you'll get 4 or 5 days of, and when the whole pulse will come in, and then there'll be nothing. And so the timing of the fishery and the your ability to assess the abundance is really related to your ability to determine those pulses. And so this drift test fishery will be a great help in that. The other increment is the Bering Sea Aleutian Islands Crab Research Project. This is a project that was funded by National Marine Fisheries Service. They cut that funding last year. The legislature gave us an increment, a one-time increment of $1 million to cover that during this current fiscal year, 2009. And we would like to continue that work. It's really, there's three elements of that. One are the king crab pot surveys. These are for the king crab stocks in the Bering Sea that are not well surveyed by the federal government. They do an annual trawl survey, but there's four stocks that are not well surveyed, either are not surveyed at all or are poorly assessed by that trawl survey. So we do these pot surveys in order to get an indication of the abundance and set guideline harvest levels for those fisheries. It also funds snow crab and tanner crab research into the biology, movements, handling mortality. Under the new overfishing limits that have been put into place in the federal program, all mortality is considered in the overfishing limit. And so if a crab boat catches undersized or female crab and releases them, there's a certain mortality factor that's actually assigned to that catch, and then that counts as part of the overall mortality. And so the higher the incidental mortality is, the lower the amount that people are allowed to catch. And so it's important to know, have accurate estimates of what that mortality is. And so this project provides a lot of that kind of information, as well as growth information that we need to set those guideline harvest levels. And finally, the observer data entry. The crab boats in the Bering Sea are required to carry observers. They pay for the observers. They collect a lot of really important biological information, but this project pays for the entry of that data into the database. And so without the funding for this project, we would have the data, but we would have no way to put it into the database and utilize it in the management of the fishery. Some of the major issues that we face in the future, recruitment and retention of staff, as Commissioner Lloyd said, is a major issue. We find it increasingly difficult to attract people to our jobs. Some of our recent recruitments, even at the higher level positions, we've had, I think I counted up yesterday that we had 8 or 9 positions that we did not have what's considered a sufficient hiring pool to choose from. And so those positions, even though they're some of the most highly paid in the department, we often get only 2 or 3 applicants. We see declining federal funds. The legislature dealt with this last year with the increment for approximately $5 million that replaced funds that were cut by the federal government that handled Bering Sea crab research, a lot of our nearshore research on species like rockfish, sea cucumbers, gooey ducks, and some of these fisheries that are developing and really are not at a real high level of knowledge. And so we see that maybe that will continue in the future. And that funding instability does create problems for us. It creates staff and morale problems when people don't know from year to year whether or not they're going to have a job, and they maybe start looking for other jobs where the funding's more stable, and you can lose a lot of good staff. We've, of course, still involved in the Pacific Salmon Treaty, federal subsistence management. In the federal arena also, the Gulf of Alaska groundfish rationalization. We face issues with extraterritorial jurisdiction. That's one of the things that we faced with the Sitka herring stock. Some of the local people there actually petitioned the Secretary of Interior to exercise extraterritorial jurisdiction, which would have closed all the fisheries for herring in Sitka, would have closed not only the commercial fishery, but also the subsistence fishery. Marine Stewardship Council recertification is another issue. We've engaged in a large number of projects to try to gather the information that they've required to continue our certification. Cook Inlet salmon management, of course, is always a hot issue. And the gooey duck aquatic farm industry, that's another one where we've been trying to work closely with the gooey duck farmers to try to develop a better set of regulations that meets their needs and also provides for protection of wild gooey ducks. Finally, our whole safety program. We've got 475 people out in field camps dealing with bears and boats and scuba diving and flying in airplanes, and we really need to develop a better safety program for them. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. That concludes my presentation. Be happy to answer any more questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hilsinger, and as the preceding 2 years, an excellent presentation.
Thank you.
We really appreciate the thoroughness and the level of detail. Questions, committee members? I can't seem to rouse a question. So with that, we'd like to thank you very much for your time today, Mr. Hilsinger. I'm sure we'll be seeing you between now and the end of the session on other issues. So with that, let me just once again remind that our next meeting, which is on Tuesday, we're going to shift it from 10 to 10:15 in the morning just to accommodate the committee that meets before us. And with that, the meeting's adjourned at 11:30. Thank you.